5882 Breaking Kayfabe. I am your host, Jeff Bowden. With me, my man, Barry Rose, fresh back from the Fan Fest in Lutz, Florida. Barry, holy crap, could you believe when Travis Raines ran naked through the lobby? I couldn't believe it. He was out of control, drunk off his ass. Yet again, probably not going to tell the wife about that one, Barry.
No, I'm definitely not going to tell my wife about that, and I don't think Travis is going to tell his wife. Jeff, we have so many stories from FanFest weekend, and it's what it really was. It wasn't just a day. It was a brothership coming together weekend. Jeff, do we do it this episode, or should we save it all for the next episode?
We probably should save it for the next episode since we're recording this before the damn FanFest, but I digress. And on this show, we're not just going to break kayfabe on Travis Raines' nudity in Lutz. We're going to break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, wrestling, life, bad 80s films. We have a little bit of everything to offer you today. Barry, we're going to take a special – we're not going to do the old CWF angle of the week this week. We are going to take a look at the list of great baby faces that the old CWF territory was built around. We're talking Eddie Graham, Jack Briscoe, and the American Dream, the Mayo, the Million Dollar Smile, Dusty Rhodes. We're going to talk about those three guys and how the territory transitioned from one lead baby face to the next and what it meant to the territory. We've got someone that knows a little bit about that. Oh, it's my old friend Barry Rose to talk about that. Besides that, special announcement forthcoming, folks. That I was going to break the news to you here on this very podcast. However, my man, the great Brian Last, with Scott Teal as a guest, in fact, has broken the story. Sons of bitches. So besides that, our match of the week, we are going to 1985, a territory that we have never been to before. We are going to Montreal as it is Jacques and Raymond, the Rougeau brothers, taking on gorgeous Jimmy Garvin and a heel Ronnie Garvin. And it was absolutely fantastic to watch the angle in the match. We're talking June 24th-ish, middle of summer 1985, our movie of the week. Holy cow, do we have a big old crap fest to talk about this week, courtesy of my friend Barry, as we're going to the unbelievable classic Savage Streets. Barry, this is going to be a fun ride.
It already is a fun ride, Jeff. We're already the wheels are cranking. We're shifting gears. This is already really exciting. And when you say a crap fest, that's maybe an understatement, but my God, is it the most entertaining crap fest in the history of crap fests?
I'm just going to say, you said that things are cranking, much like one of the co-stars of the movie appeared to be on screen, but I digress. Yeah. So, Barry, let's start off with a look back at the old championship wrestling from Florida days. And as everyone knows, we basically had three eras of the promotion. We had the Eddie Graham era, we had the Jack Briscoe era, and we had the Dusty Rhodes era. So we're looking, let's give us some context here, Barry. When did Eddie Graham first become the lead babyface in the promotion? According
probably
to your
1962 is probably. So if you were to go, when you stop and think about this for a second, you've got three baby faces. There is a fourth baby face there that was the transition, the bridge, if you will, between Jack Briscoe and Dusty Rhodes, which was old Puddinhead, Paul Jones, in his pre-Puddinhead days. But you really did have three. And it went 1962 until Dusty left, which was 84. But Dusty would still make appearances in 85. So, you know, you're talking over a 22, maybe 23-year period of three lead baby faces. So that's kind of astounding when you stop and think about it.
Yeah, and, you know, each guy had their own, stamp on the territory. You know, Eddie, very consistent baby face. Jack, very consistent baby face. And then Dusty with the great angle just exploded and had about a 10-year run. Is that fair to say, Barry?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely it was, yeah.
Yeah. So let's take a look back. Now, let's begin with Eddie. What do you know about Eddie and how he first came? Of course, Eddie had the famous run in Madison Square Garden with Dr. Jerry. Cue the Vandal Drummond sound clip of Dr. Jerry saying something inappropriate. So we had Dr. Jerry and Eddie. Eddie leaves and eventually makes his way down to Florida with Cowboy Luttrell. And tell us some about the early days of Eddie Graham.
Yeah, Yeah, so this is so Cowboy Luttrell and Eddie Graham, which was Eddie Gossett at that point, knew each other from Chattanooga. Eddie was born and raised in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and they actually knew each other from Chattanooga. So Eddie was, you know, you could look at photos. I've got photos that I posted, which came from his daughter, his granddaughter, and Eddie, even as a 17-year-old kid, looked like Eddie Graham. Like, he didn't look like a 17-year-old kid. Like, he always kind of looked the same to me. So Cowboy Luttrell, I guess, took a real liking to him, had a hand in training him, getting him smart for this business. And when the time was right, he brought him down to Florida, made him the lead babyface, and really made him his right-hand man, taught him everything that he knew. And Eddie had a mind for the business. Everybody will tell you, you know, you're talking great minds in professional wrestling. You're talking about guys like Cowboy Bill Watts, George Scott at one point, you know, and Eddie Graham. That's, you know, and Red Bastien. There are certain guys who had a real mind for the business. So Eddie shows up, comes into Florida, late 50s, actually. He was in and out, but he came in as a heel, was Eddie Gossett. And then at some point, he transitioned from heel Eddie Gossett to babyface Eddie Graham, and at that point became the top babyface in the state, and he really held on to that up until about 1969, 1968, when he suffered that accident that we discussed, you know, over either last week or the week before, with the window in the Fort Hesterly Armory falling on his head, or not, as the story goes. But he had a pretty solid run. But I think the idea was to bring Eddie in to really train him, to get him to understand every facet of the business, you know, behind the scenes and the ring, et cetera. And then I don't know if it was ever Cowboy Luttrell's, you know, idea from the get-go that one day Eddie would take over for him. But at the same thing, I think he felt that he could trust Eddie, that Eddie was kind of like a son. And Cowboy never had a son. He had a daughter, obviously. You and I both know Belinda extremely well, but never had a son. And I always felt that Eddie was the son that Cowboy Luttrell never had. So came in, you know, late 50s, by the early 60s, by 61, 62, he was a full-time regular. Began his feud with the great Malenko and really continued up until, you know, that accident. That accident that occurred, really, I don't think Eddie was quite ever the same. But he continued. He continued into the 70s and, you know, was still wrestling into the early 80s very, very infrequently. And it was kind of like, okay, you know, Eddie Graham, the hardest punch in wrestling, in the top 10 for the last decade, always two things that Gordon Solie always said about him. But, you know, he was the man for years. Because of the accident in 69 is when the emergence of Jack Briscoe came in. Briscoe was great. Briscoe wasn't a guy that was working a lot of other territories, but he had worked Oklahoma, and I think that was it. And then he wound up in Florida, and this would have been 1969. And he was kind of like, they didn't push him to main events right out of the gate, but he was getting the push, and you could see the future was being written if you go back and you look at the matches and the listings and the results. And within a year, Jack Briscoe was your guy. And it was really the feud with Dory Funk Jr. that made Jack Briscoe in a lot of ways. And he certainly had, you know, he feuded with the Missouri Mauler, and he feuded with Dick Dunn, who was the good doctor, and, you know, and Mr. Saito. So he was having these feuds with people, Dale Lewis, but it was this feud where he was positioned as the top contender for Dory Funk Jr. And that really propelled him in the state. He, at that point, became the guy, the man. And it was kind of passing off the torch. You know, it was Eddie Graham, you know, much like Cowboy Luttrell in some ways had said, you know, in Cowboy Luttrell, we should say, even as a fairly young man, and I'm talking in his 50s into 60s, had severe health issues. And he stepped down in the early 70s, and Eddie Graham took over. And there's been a lot of conjecture out there, did Eddie Graham steal the territory from Cowboy Luttrell? And regardless of whatever you hear or whatever people think that they know, I can tell you that, you know, in my conversations with Cowboy's daughter, there is zero animosity. They considered the Graham family family. You know, that this was a family to them. So the territory wasn't stolen from Cowboy Luttrell, again, regardless of whatever people will try to tell you. So Jack Briscoe emerged. Eddie Graham, he knew his days were behind him. And Briscoe emerged in the early 70s. And really, to me, he kind of set the standard for professional wrestling. I was talking to our good friend the other day, Mr. Technical, Barry Horowitz, who absolutely loves our show, Jeff. He's listening to it. He loves it.
And why shouldn't he?
Exactly. Absolutely. And he's absolutely just thrilled. And, you know, and we were talking about professional wrestling. And, you know, I said a lot of people will say they became fans because of Dusty Rhodes. And I got to be honest, because, you know, to me, that's pre-74. I'm pre-74. You know, I became a fan because of Jack Briscoe, and much probably like you did, like a lot of people did.
Yes,
Jack Briscoe was the real deal. And that was the beauty of what CWF did, is that CWF was putting legitimate wrestlers in the position of being their guys on top. You know, Eddie Graham could take care of himself. Eddie Graham, if you go back and you look at footage of Eddie Graham in his heyday, and there's not a lot that's out there, but I've got a DVD, and I mean, you know, he looks believable. The key is he's super believable when you watch him in the ring. And, you know, Jack Briscoe, even until his last match, and, you know, we reviewed one of his last matches probably a year ago, Jeff, when we were doing the Briscoes versus Adonis and Murdoch, and he still looked great. Jack Briscoe was still, in my opinion, could still go. There was nothing there. A little balder, that was about it. The guy in the ring was still 4 stars, so he was the real deal. And I know that you were a huge Jack Briscoe fan.
Sure. No, I started watching wrestling, at least, you know, after I went to my first match in Savannah, Georgia, at the Civic Center. And I came to Florida and I got hooked watching Jack Briscoe and Dory Funk Jr. And, you know, they would end the show with Gordon Solie calling the end of the match, and Dory's holding on as Jack has the figure four leg lock that was taught to him by Eddie Graham. And he's hanging on, and it's 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, boom, draw. And they brought that match back, and sometimes they would extend it out to 60 minutes and even longer than that. No time limit. And that stuff, you know, for a kid my age at the time, that was gold, man. That was, you're locked in on Saturdays at 12 on WCIX Channel 6 here in Miami, and you are watching that bad boy.
Yeah, and he, again, the key is, and I think this was the key with a lot of what we saw in Florida, at least before the Dusty era, and we can certainly get into it. And it's not really a knock on Dusty, but the believability factor of professional wrestling in the state prior to Dusty was 100% all the way across the board. You know, Eddie was putting, like, you had Buddy Colt, you had this threesome, and I've said this a million times, but between the years of 72 to late 73, early 74, you had Paul Jones, who was both a babyface and a heel, a babyface Jack Briscoe and a heel Buddy Colt. And any one of those three were feuding with each other. And at times, they were all feuding with each other. And any of that combination in a match, you would sit and you would go, holy shit, this is what professional wrestling is supposed to be. And Paul Jones, and I've said this probably a half dozen times over the last year and a half, he's maligned. Paul Jones is maligned because, never a stellar interview on, you know, at least in my opinion, but his role as a manager was not great. And, you know, that's a fact. He was not a great manager. It didn't quite work. But as a wrestler in the early 70s, Paul Jones was legit as shit. And he was a former AAU boxer. And his punches, if you look, they looked 100% real. The same as Briscoe's. Briscoe's punches were just, you know, off the charts. Buddy Colt's another one. You know, this was believable. And that's what we'll never see. And look, wrestling right now, and that's, you know, I don't want to be, you know, get off my lawn, kids. I don't want to be that old guy. But, you know, with guys like Will Ospreay, and Will Ospreay is a fantastic professional wrestler, but the believability factor is not there, because the moves that he does aren't moves that you would see in, quote-unquote, a fight. You know, you're not going to see some of that flippy shit in a fight. You got Briscoe into a ring, Paul Jones into a ring, and Buddy Colt. You believe these guys were actually killing each other. So there was a big difference right there. Real stellar. And Paul Jones was the guy that I was talking about. So he was kind of the transition bridge. So you had Eddie Graham. The baton is passed off to Jack Briscoe. Jack Briscoe wins the world's heavyweight title, meaning he's not going to be around Florida on a weekly basis anymore. Who do we make the top babyface? By default, it goes to Paul Jones, and that's a position he holds essentially for maybe the next 8 months or so. Until then it goes to Dusty.
Yeah, and, you know, you make a good point. Paul Jones, so believable in his role. And, you know, it's like you said, it started on that in that trio of matches, you know, any combination of Colt, Jones, you know, and Briscoe. Those matches were always gold, Barry. And so then, of course, and we haven't got to it in our top 25 angles yet. But here's a big reveal, breaking kayfabe for all you folks that haven't figured it out yet. The number one angle is Dusty Rhodes becoming a babyface. And we're going to get to a show down the road where we just strictly talk about that angle, the execution of that angle, and the impact that it had on the area for the next 10 years. But so Dusty Rhodes becomes the top babyface. And Dusty, as Barry said, was kind of the antithesis of Jack Briscoe. And for people that were fans of Jack Briscoe and Eddie Graham, and going back even further than that, Barry has mentioned that they thought Dusty was essentially kind of a showboat. And this was not the wrestling that they had watched before. And isn't it interesting, Barry, how things, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Because now here you mention Will Ospreay and, you know, guys like the Young Bucks and Kenny Omega, and people are so into them. And of course, older fans, maybe like you and me and people our age, sit there, oh, that's different. That's not the stuff we grew up on. Well, guess what? The people that grew up watching Eddie Graham and Jack Briscoe, when Dusty Rhodes hit it big and just exploded, they were all going, oh, this isn't the stuff that we're used to watching. You know, and things change, Barry, but they stay the same.
Jeff, you're 100% correct.
God, so we got to get that on a shirt. We really do.
We really do have to get that on a shirt. But you're 100% correct in the fact that there is a generational transition in professional wrestling that occurs. Look, there are people now that look back at the Hulk Hogan era in the 80s with utter fondness. I mean, do you remember how horrific that shit was, Jeff?
Well,
it still is when you go. I mean, honestly, when you go back and you watch it, a lot of that is just absolutely terrible. But there are people out there that go, you know, why? Because they were 9 years old. So it comes from their childhood, and they look at it and they go, oh my God, you know, I really miss Hulk Hogan versus Kamala, or Hulk Hogan versus King Kong Bundy in the five count. And it's like, I remember, and I actually like Kamala. Bundy, not as much, but I actually did enjoy Kamala for what he was. But you're right in what you, when you say that, is that Florida was a really interesting territory, in that pre-Dusty, it was built on people that had amateur credentials. So you would get people that, you know, that weren't maybe collegiate or AAU wrestlers. But at the same time, you know, a guy like Paul Jones, I don't know if he ever wrestled amateur, but I know as a boxer, he certainly was a boxer. Buddy Colt, certainly a believable heel and super Colt-like figure, too, because if you follow Buddy Colt in the CWF Archives Facebook group, there's the Colt of Colt. I mean, there are people that he was the greatest heel of all time. These people are absolutely convinced of it. But there was a diametric shift that occurred in 1974 when Dusty became the lead babyface. And we went from, you know, a guy who was a pure athlete like a Jack Briscoe, like a Paul Jones, to Dusty Rhodes. And don't get me wrong, Dusty was obviously an athlete, to, you know, considering what he did, but he certainly didn't look like an athlete. That's not a knock on him. And he was, you know, Dusty, pardon me, Jeff, my dinner's coming back up right now.
Oh, but, well, that's nice to hear.
And yeah, it was good. You know, we can, it's always good to talk about your dinner, but it was, I think a lot of people remember Dusty. If we were to take a poll, people are going to remember Dusty from his, NWA Crockett days and his feud with the Horsemen, when really that was not the peak of Dusty. But if you look, go back and you look at Dusty 1972 and 1974 in CWF, he was really amazing in the fact that he was probably 260 pounds, 270 pounds, but he moved like he was a junior heavyweight. He had this really bizarre speed for a guy who didn't look like an athlete. So he was really incredible. But it was a real shift of guys like Jack Briscoe, like Roop, who was in the Olympics for professional wrestling, Dale Lewis, you know, all these guys who had all these credentials, to all of a sudden we did become more of a show. And it wasn't that way right from the get-go, but it certainly transitioned maybe within 2 years, maybe 3 years, where it was the Dusty Rhodes Show. And as I said on last week's episode, and you just referenced, a lot of the old timers would sit there and go, yeah, he's a showman, you know, but man, if you would have seen, you know, Eddie Graham and Greg Malenko, or you know, and you watched Jack Briscoe and Dory Funk Jr. go 90 minutes and you're not bored. I mean, you're completely riveted by the story. That really says something. So you had three main baby faces, which really, I think, says a lot. You know, it's kind of like Memphis. You think of Memphis, you think of really two people, at least in my opinion. You think of Jackie Fargo, you think of Jerry the King Lawler. So Florida had three: Eddie Graham, Jack Briscoe, and Dusty Rhodes, with Paul Jones as that bridge in 1973 to 74.
Yeah, and I think, you know, perhaps maybe the intention was, you know, maybe there have been plans for Barry Windham to become that next guy in the chain. But of course, by that point, the business was changing so much and Florida just kind of started falling by the wayside. So, you know, for those of us that were following Florida and, you know, the 85, 86, 80, I'm not even going to talk about the Lex Luger portion of that equation.
But to that point, so Barry Windham, absolutely. And Barry Windham, to some degree, if you were going to put the tag on somebody after Dusty, he would probably deserve it on a couple of different levels. Certainly his in-ring work. I mean, Barry Windham, we've talked about it numerous times. At his best, Barry Windham was as good really as anybody in the U.S., but there were two guys that they were really trying to hang their hat on, which neither really took off. One was Luger, who took off to some degree, I guess, because his physique was unlike, I think, any physique. It was almost like superstar Billy Graham in some ways, you know. But he was obviously in the ring. It wasn't quite working, and it was, you know, it was just noticeable. CWF at that point, you know, as we're getting to 85 and then 86, you know, you're drawing 1,000 people to the arena, so that buzz, that energy wasn't there. The other one they brought in, if you remember this, was Scott Hall. And they brought in Scott Hall, and this was, I think, 85, I forget, you know, 80, but it was short-lived. And they brought in Scott Hall, and they claimed on television they had signed Scott Hall to a million-dollar contract. And this was really, you know, everybody and their mother knew that was total bullshit, because this is when they were drawing 1,000 people. This wasn't like the old days when you were drawing 5,000 on a weekly basis. So crowds were way down, and they brought in Scott Hall, and it just didn't work. You know, Scott, I don't know how long he was here, a couple of months maybe. And he's from Orlando. I mean, he was a Florida guy, but it just didn't work at all. So I would say, if you were looking, I would say Windham probably gets that tag after Dusty. But here's one for you, Jeff, and I'm going to blindside you with this because we didn't talk about this. So we just discussed the baby faces, certainly in great lengths for some 20 or 25 minutes, according to Lou Kippelman, Sweet Lou. But on the heel side, who gets the nod for the heels? So obviously you're starting off with the great Malenko. You have to, considered the greatest heel in the history of CWF. And then you have to kind of bookend that and say, okay, when the promotion was in its last few years, it's got to go to Kevin Sullivan, because A, the originality of the angles that he was doing, but his tenure, the length of time that he was here. But who falls into that middle period, which is primarily the 1970s? Who gets the nod of the heels of the 1970s? And I don't think there was a clear-cut heel in the 70s, where I think you can absolutely say Malenko in the 60s, and you can absolutely say Sullivan in the 80s. Where do you go in the 70s? And a lot of people will say it's Buddy Colt. What would you say?
Well, I think, you know, it was Buddy Colt before, of course, the accident. And then after Dusty became the lead babyface, essentially what you had was you had a run of guys that were brought in that rotated out every 6 to 9 months that were, you know, fodder for Dusty. And, you know, they would do the angle where they killed Dusty and then Dusty makes the big heroic comeback and they've got an angle that works, you know, for X amount of time. And a new guy comes in and if the guy, you know, was really successful, eventually Eddie would bring him back. And so there was really nobody that, you know, Malenko was part of the promotion. I think we've talked about it for like something like 9 years. And Buddy Colt was part of the promotion for, geez, what, like before the plane accident, what, a good 3 or 4 years? Sullivan had a good 3 or 4 year run, but I don't know if we had anyone that had that kind of run for that kind of length.
They didn't, and I think that, so if I was to say, you know, I don't think it is Buddy Colt, and I'll tell you, because I think he made a very strong impression, but you're looking at Buddy Colt over maybe a 2 to 2.5 year period in Florida. He left, he came back, and when he came back, he was only around for less than a month before the actual plane accident. I think he was coming from Georgia, so his run was absolutely incredible because he made a massive impression on people who think he's one of the greatest of all time. And he was. But at the same time, I just think from that standpoint of just a couple of years, I can't say it. My opinion, I think it's Terry Funk. And I think,
well, I was going to say Terry, but, you know, the Funks were in and out. I was going to say also, you know, I know you've talked about the Ernie Ladd thing, Jody Hamilton as the Mask Assassin. These guys were all great, but I don't know if any of them had the length and breadth of a stay like a Malenko did, you know, nothing even remotely like that. But yeah, I mean, quite frankly, you had a guy that was your lead babyface that didn't call for that, you know. Funk, they could bring in and out and keep, you know, this will never be over kind of thing like they did with Ole in Georgia. But nobody of a staying power of a Malenko or a Sullivan. And, you know, there are those that could argue that Sullivan, you know, I've pointed out, you know, those that could argue, I'm talking about myself, that Sullivan stayed on top too long, that they just had the angle go too long because Dusty, I think, quite frankly, had run out of ideas and, you know, maybe Sullivan was helping him in the office and just, you know, I mean, if you're going to want to be Machiavellian about it, Kevin knew where his bread was buttered. Hey, I got another great idea for you and I. And, you know, maybe that's what it was. I'm not, you know. But I wanted to point out two guys that you didn't mention as you were talking about the end there and Scott Hall being a guy they wanted to transition to. Scott Hall, famously called by Coach John Heath, Mr. Big Scott Hall. I'll never forget that.
That's right.
Also, besides Lex, a guy they brought in after Scott was Alan Coage. And I remember because there was a great vignette where Gordon went out to dinner with Bad News Alan. And they wanted to just make Alan like this man of the people. And he and Gordon were sitting there having dinner and a couple of cocktails. And it was so awesome. But the promotion by that point was just really kind of in the can and ready to kind of hit the highway and just be taken over by JCP. So I think we've pretty much hit the highlights on that there, folks. Like I said, we'll eventually be getting to that number one angle and go really in depth on the turn that completely changed the face of championship wrestling from Florida. And I know when we get there, Barry, you will certainly have lots to talk about with that angle.
Oh, that's for sure. Absolutely too. And I think it changed more than just CWF. It changed the face of professional wrestling because Dusty, if you were going to talk about the top baby faces in professional wrestling in the 1970s, who would it be? And in my opinion, it was Dusty and Andre. And maybe Mil Mascaris after a certain point, you know, after the IWA, because Mascaris was really going in and out of territories as a special attraction. Andre was, you know, Andre could go anywhere. He would draw a crowd. He was making money. But Dusty was the same way. Dusty, he would go to Florida. Then he was, you know, doing a shot or two in Georgia. He would be in Houston, Texas. Maybe he's in the AWA. He's in Madison Square Garden on top. Dusty was everywhere, and he was drawing. He was super, super popular. So I think that's a great topic maybe down the road, Jeff, where we talk about the top heels or top baby faces of a decade, not just even a territory, you know, something along those lines.
Yeah, and I can remember that Bill Apter did an article in, I don't know if it was Inside Wrestling or The Wrestler or one of those magazines where they talked about Dusty's schedule. And this must have been like, I don't know, late 70s, maybe 1980, where they talked about 190s. And as you said, the Garden, the one place you left out was he was appearing quite a bit in, you know, in Louisiana and, yeah, you know, for Bill Watts and stuff.
Literally everywhere, there, except for Memphis. He would say, you know.
Yeah, no, but I mean, like, I know he headlined a couple of Superdomes, I think. I know he and Andre worked as a tag team against. Never forget his great heel tandem, the Assassin and the Angel. I never quit. They made that into a Superdome main event. That was crazy. So
and quite frankly, and I think that they drew like a record number.
Yeah,
that's the genius of Cowboy Bill Watts.
Yeah, no question about it. So, and by the way, there's a heel we didn't mention, Barry, Cowboy Bill Watts. You know, definitely a guy that needs to be mentioned as, you know, one of the great heels of the 70s for Florida.
Yeah, and I think the only issue, I think Bill Watts was both heel and babyface in Florida, but his run was, what a boom period for the state, and he was really responsible along with Dusty, you know, during that era. He was the booker when the Dusty turn took place. So
He was
booker.
Him the booker. Is that what you're saying?
So they call him the booker. So, Jeff, anything new in your world?
That's a smooth transition, wasn't it? I kind of like that.
That's aces right there. Absolutely.
So, yes, special announcement. They call me the booker. Crowbar Press, Scott Teal. Boom. The book is now available, Barry. Yes, we're going back to, dare I say, there's a phrase that I get called out on. Dare I say, we're going back to 1991-ish, maybe late 1990. We're going back to the pages of the Wrestling Observer. And I did a series of articles that lasted, about 9 months in the Observer, a series of articles that was never finished. In the Observer. Go ahead, ask me why that series was never finished.
This is crazy. I was just going to say, why was this never finished?
Well, it wasn't Dave Meltzer. No, Dave wouldn't do that to me. You know what it was? It was that son of a bitch, Vince McMahon, on trial with the feds, caused my series of articles to be preempted. How dare he? That's what started all the heat between me and Vince McMahon. I don't mind telling you. But so anyway, so what happened was I started a series of articles where I basically became the booker for WCW, which quite frankly was having some hard times at that point. And what had happened, the story started from a series of phone calls, much like Barron's and myself, how this podcast started. Dave and I would talk pretty regularly on the phone about, oh my God, can you believe what the kind of crap they're putting on TV for WCW? And I sat there one day, I was sitting in court, and I was like, you know what, if I was the booker of WCW, what the hell would I be doing? And of course, I gave myself a good budget, courtesy of Ted Turner, who owned WCW at the time. So I took some creative license. I'll just be able to say that. I also, however, had to factor in when guys quit the promotion or had a hissy fit about doing a job. So I had to work real life into my storyline. And so I let it run for, I want to say, the better part of 9 months. But the finish to the articles, the end of Baudrin the Booker, they call me the Booker. Let me just say it one more time, just in case the people didn't hear. Has never been revealed until this book, Barry, and it's being, you know, debuted. It was debuted at the big fan fest, and now it is available through crowbarpress.com and my good friend Scott Teal.
Debuted at the fan fest. So when you think about all this shit, Travis Reigns running naked through the lobby, a book was debuted. A book from the booker was debuted. A man who now has two books underneath his belt that you can get autographed. And Jeff, how much is this book going for? It's whatever, it doesn't matter. It's a bargain.
It's priceless.
$100. It's a bargain.
Priceless.
It's priceless. There you go. It's absolutely priceless. And Luke Kippelman checking in, publishing party at the International Beer Garden.
Well, that may have happened. We can't talk about it. You know, we'll reveal all those details next week.
Absolutely. But that's it, because we are recording prior. That's a great fucking idea, Lou, actually. Jeff, you can take the book over. That's genius right there. Absolutely.
I'll sign some books for the girls.
So I'm very excited about this. It's, I think it is super cool that we're actually debuting it at the Fan Fest. So I encourage everybody. Everybody's going to want to get a copy of this book. So a couple of things first off, I can't believe it was only 9 months, because when you stop and think about it, we're looking now, this is 28 years ago that you did this, 28 years ago, and you're still known as the booker, and it was only 9 months. You know, it isn't like you were doing it for like 10 years. So that actually is a testament. Secondly, I was listening to your appearance this a couple of weeks ago on the Stick to Wrestling podcast. And I got to say, you were fantastic on that show, Jeff. You really owned the hour that you were on, without a doubt. But John McAdam made a comment in there, and I'm going to assume that John listens to our podcast, because I think I've said this a half dozen times, but that whole genius of Brad Armstrong, when you converted Brad Armstrong, he becomes a heel and he changes his name to Brad Watts as the adopted son of Bill Watts. I've been raving about that for years. I know I've mentioned it numerous times on this podcast. So it was nice to hear somebody else blatantly, you know, take my idea, what I always say, and say it somewhere else. But it really was great. But that's the kind of stuff that you're going to see in here. And that's what I think was so unique about that, because I used to look forward to reading that in The Observer. And I got to admit, while the Zahorian trial was certainly current and it's arguably one of the bigger stories, probably in the annals of or annals of professional wrestling, it was nowhere near as exciting as the weekly Baldrin the Booker segment in The Observer.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, when I was going back and I was doing a little bit of editing, and what one of the things I did, and Scott referred to this on the 605, is I went back with the benefit of, as you said, 28 years of hindsight. And I looked back and I talked about what angles I think would have really gotten over. And, you know, quite honestly, there were some that I was like, hey, yeah, this wouldn't have worked. You know, there would have been problems with this angle for whatever reason. And, you know, I felt like I was kind of candid where I said, yeah, this was kind of been a clusterfuck. But then there were other stuff that I thought would have been really, really effective. And I think the Brad Armstrong, you know, I mentioned, I think on our last episode, Brad was a guy that I think was crying for a change in his character, because he was so good. He was Mr. Technical before Mr. Technical, for God's sakes. But he was so good, and he had this personality that, for whatever reason, as a babyface, just didn't get over. And, you know, if you had that tag team where he was standing there with his dad, and his dad could talk, and his dad could talk anybody into a seat, and then, you know, put Brad in the ring and let Brad do all the work, it was a great combination. But, you know, Brad was one of those guys that, you know, and it's funny because I've talked to guys that work with Brad who's no longer with us, and he's one of those guys that I just really, really miss not having. I would have loved to have interviewed Brad Armstrong for this show. They said Brad, behind the scenes, was a great guy, a great character. He would, you know, cut jokes and play, you know, little friendly ribs on the boys and keep them laughing and stitches, and then he'd get in front of the camera and the lights would go on and boom. You just didn't see that personality, that you didn't see that Brad Armstrong that the boys saw in the dressing room. And it's really sad, you know. And then you had guys that, you know, when that light came on, boom, you know, that they were gold in front of, like, his dad, Bob Armstrong. Tell me a better interviewer that you can think of. You know, when you talk about the great talkers that maybe, you know, as he got older, Bob was not quite as effective in the ring as he had been. Bob Armstrong and Smoky Mountain was the guy that put asses in the seats, because he was such an effective interview. And the interplay between him and Jim Cornette was absolute freaking vocal gold, because you had a guy that Jim Cornette could talk all kind of trash to, and yet there was Bob Armstrong talking and giving it right back to him. And the interplay between the two of them, I still remember. That's been 25 years ago. And it's just great shit. And, you know, some of the other stuff I did, you know, not to be one of those guys that gives away everything in the book that people haven't read about. But, you know, I did some interesting and fun things with Buddy Landell. And, you know, and of course, one of the other things that, as I look back and as I was doing, you know, some editing, I look back and, you know, it's really sad, Barry. You and I, again, another thing we've talked about is how many guys that were around back then that aren't with us anymore. And of course, you know, for a litany of reasons, you know, one of the teams that I focused on and made my lead babyface tag team was Owen Hart and Chris Benoit. And yeah. I had them feuding with the Midnight Express in my storyline. And some of the stuff that I came up with, the angles and, you know, all the different, plot stuff with Jim Cornette. And, you know, it's a long story that, quite frankly, you're going to have to read. But I thought it was a really effective way to have brought those guys in. And, you know, as you talk about transitioning from one team, you know, the Rock and Roll had kind of had their run, and as great as they were, and you're never going to hear us talk bad about Ricky and Robert, because we love those guys. But, you know, they were getting a little long in the tooth. The Fantastics has had their run. And I think it would have been a great time to bring in another tag team and put them over huge. And it couldn't be somebody like, you know, Shane Douglas and Johnny Ace, for God's sakes. It had to be somebody that was a little bit, you know, had their own way to go. And, you know, one of the things we talk about, you were mentioning Lex Luger. I'm going to just go back to the CWF thing for a second. You know, one of the things that I always felt at the time and really in hindsight is, let's be honest, the guy that had changed the face of the wrestling business in 1984 was Hulk Hogan, and even maybe a year or two before that. And so what happened was you had all these promotions scrambling to find the next Hulk Hogan. And the problem was that the next Hulk Hogan, who cares? You don't want the same thing. You know, the reason The Rock got over was because he wasn't Stone Cold Steve Austin. You know, the reason Bret Hart got over was because he wasn't Hulk Hogan. All these promotions, whether it was Lex Luger, Ed the Bull Gantner, Scott Hall, these guys were looking for the next Lex Luger. Oh, I'm sorry, the next Hulk Hogan. And that wasn't what you should be looking for. You should be looking for the next hot ticket item that wasn't Hulk Hogan, because you know, that to me was what was going to make a difference. You know, Dusty Rhodes got over and we had that great, you know, run for 10 years. But guess what? Hulk Hogan wasn't. He wasn't Dusty Rhodes. He was something completely different, you know. And I think that's where some of these promotions really missed the boat. Instead of coming up with the next Hulk Hogan, they should have come up with the next big thing and the next big different thing.
Yeah. And look at the last, at least in my opinion, the last great babyface in the U.S. to get over, in my opinion, was Daniel Bryan. And Daniel Bryan was no carbon copy of any of the names that you just mentioned. He was completely different. So history will tell you, again, the greatest indicator of the future is history. History will tell you if you're going to push a babyface, he shouldn't be a carbon copy of somebody else. It shouldn't be the next Hulk Hogan, the next Dusty Rhodes, anything like that. The people want something unique. They want something different. So I agree. Well, Jeff, I think you just did a great job selling the book. I think 2,000 copies were just sold. I might be wrong.
I think at least 1,000 to your Green Bombs, your Zahas, all those guys. And so I certainly hope we will post the information on how to obtain said copy of the book. And of course, if you'd like to reach out to me for a personalized copy and one that's autographed and maybe personalized to you, I'm certainly happy to do that. And we will make that information available to you. Now, Barry, it's time for us to go to 1985. No, not Hulk Hogan. We're going to Montreal. We are talking the Rougeau brothers versus the Garvins, June of 1985. So a little context here, Barry. It's another phrase I use a lot. I'm surprised I haven't been called out on that. A little context here. So what we had was we had the match from, I believe, June 24th, 1985, that was scheduled that did not quite take place. The big angle that led to the loser leave town match, Barry, why don't you tell the folks about what happened that led to that loser leave town match?
Absolutely, too. So I love this angle. So you've got Ronnie and Jimmy Garvin versus Jacques Rougeau Jr. and Raymond Rougeau. And I think this was called the Saint Jean Baptiste Massacre, June 24th, 1985, taking some place in Quebec, Canada. I'm assuming Montreal. So really, just going back here, too, Ronnie Garvin, real name, I believe, is Roger Barnes, a true French Canadian, Verdun, Quebec, Lou Kippelman, Czech. Lou, why don't you join us? Because you saw this match as well. Sweet Lou, knock,
yes,
knock.
Yes, indeed. Oh, I'm there here.
There he is.
Always a pleasure to have you join us, Lou.
Oh, always a pleasure to join.
Absolutely. So Ronnie was a true French-Canadian. Jimmy, not quite. Jimmy, I believe, was from Tampa. And at one point, Ronnie was actually the stepfather of Jimmy Garvin. So it wasn't, these weren't two brothers. This was a guy that was married to Jimmy's mother at one point. And apparently, as the story goes, they don't get along in real life too well. So even though they had worked this whole Montreal deal and they had worked in Crockett just a few years later in TBS, these were two guys that really didn't get along too well. But this is a great angle, too, and there was a lot of heat. You could feel the heat just coming off the screen for this one. All four men are in the ring. The lovely and talented Precious is in the face of Jacques Rougeau Jr. and Ronnie Garvin. And let's be honest, this is the Ronnie fucking Garvin show from A to Z. This is unbelievable. He's got a can of something. He sprays it in Jacques Rougeau Jr.'s eyes, and then the beatdown occurs. and they just start beating the shit. Jacques Jr. gets beaten up. He's blinded. He can't do anything. He gets bloodied. Raymond gets beaten up. And then the old man jumps in the ring, Jacques Sr., who's a legend in Quebec, Canada, and he jumps in the ring. He throws, I don't know how old he was in 1985, but he has long since been retired from professional wrestling. He throws, in my opinion, some of the most realistic wrestling punches I might have ever seen. He's just laying them out. Garvin's get the hold on him. He goes down. He gets his ass beat. I mean, they get Jimmy gets him in a Boston Crab, and Ronnie jumps off the top rope with the knee across the back of the neck. He gets stretchered out. The place looks like it's erupting. The Garvins leave the ring. Then they come back and beat down two occurs, and they do it again. So Senior gets stretchered out. Jacques Jr. is blinded. I don't know where the fuck Raymond was. Lou, where was Raymond during all of this?
Well, Raymond was laid out a little bit. I remember one point, I think it was during beatdown number two, that Ronnie again came off the top onto Jacques Sr. and then popped right up because Raymond was prone on the mat right next to his dad. Ronnie dropped the elbow, picked up Raymond, and gave him what I consider the first ever wedgie pile driver. Just pulled the guy by his tights.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah. Adding insult to injury, pulls him up by the bottom of his tights, and then does a jumping pile driver.
Yeah, and that, it was a solid, I mean, it was a solid pile driver, and they must have, Ronnie must have come off the top rope onto Jacques Sr., I'll say three or four times, but just a really, really well done angle. And Jeff, you and I were talking off air about this, but how astounding was this version of Ronnie Garvin?
Well, first of all, let me just say that, yeah, as I was trying to figure out, you know, the way I could describe this to people that aren't familiar with Jacques Sr., this would be the equivalent of like Eddie Graham being taken out by a heel team as Mike and Steve Kern get beat up, or Greg Gagne and Jim Brunzel and Vern comes down and then Vern gets stretchered out. Jacques Rougeau was a huge deal in the Quebec area and especially in Montreal. So this was like seeing their living legend, you know, Eddie or Vern or somebody like that get stretchered out, or even, you know, Jackie Fargo in Memphis, something like that. Jacques Sr. was a huge, huge deal for the people in Montreal and Quebec. So this happens, and, you know, crazy time because Ronnie Garvin, the heel Ronnie Garvin, the Ronnie Garvin, but by God, I called for all during that run during the 80s when he and Flair were having their series. Why didn't they do a double turn? Because Ronnie Garvin would have been such an effect. And I know they changed him later, I think in like 88 or something like that. But by that time, his run on top was gone. But I always said that I thought Ronnie Garvin as a heel against a turn, you know, if they had done the double turn the way that Austin and Brett did, that, you know, turn Ronnie heel and Flair babyface, I think that would have been some gold. And I think they really, really missed the boat because this Ronnie Garvin, I have to tell you, I was watching the match and I texted Barry and I said, holy shit, Ronnie Garvin is absolutely amazing, you know, taking crazy bumps and selling his ass off. And he looks absolutely awesome as a heel.
Yeah, I mean, and he does. And there's when the match starts, too, and this is the revenge match that takes place, there's the opening spot where Jacques Jr., and he's really good as well. We got to say Jacques Jr. was actually really good. He and Ronnie are slapping the shit out of each other. They may be 10 slaps each, and these are those hard open palm slaps to the chest. Not like a chop per se, more like a slap, but just really, really stiff looking. Now let me ask you a question. Lou, maybe you know the answer to this one too.
Uh-huh.
Montreal tag matches. Two referees?
I noticed that too, and I wonder if that's just a sort of idiosyncrasy of the territory, like they had two refs for tag matches in St. Louis.
So
then, as you said, Barry, the match, I think, must have been the next week. It's a loser leave town match. The clip that we watched is, I want to say 15 minutes tops. But this is super heated. And, you know, again, Ronnie and Jimmy bumping their ass off. Jimmy was really moving because I got to be honest with you. By 1985, he had had his world-class run. He had gone to the AWA and had a series of matches with Rick Martel. But before he ended up going back to WCW, you know, with Crockett, I should say, you know, I think Jimmy had started to kind of go downhill a little bit. I'm talking about as far as his work rate, his personality and his character was tremendous. I remember my friend Jeff Steele always talking about how Jimmy Garvin was out injured and he created a program with Wahoo McDaniel on TBS just by sending in interviews and talking crap about Wahoo. But so this Jimmy Garvin in the ring, I think it started his downhill slide. But in this match, Jimmy Garvin is really effective in his role. Not, you know, he's bumping all over the place. Ronnie looks tremendous. And the Rougeaus are super over as baby faces. They're really, I got to be honest with you, they're a really underrated tag team. You know, they had, you know, a lot of people remember them because of the incident with the Bulldogs and stuff like that. But, you know, Jacques Rougeau, of course, had spent a lot of time in the South. As I want to say his name was Jerry Roberts. Does that sound about right, Barry?
Yeah, that's right.
He worked in Florida, Georgia, in the Gulf Coast area, Southeastern, as Jerry Roberts. And it was funny. He was in, much like Jimmy Garvin, actually, very similar. He was in Florida. I want to say it was 1979. And it was obvious that this was Jacques Rougeau Jr. And I said, aren't you Jacques Rougeau Jr.? And he gave me the, no, I'm not, but the family are good friends of mine. which Bo James, if you remember, so there was a wrestler named Bo James in Florida in 1977, and I went up to him and I said, aren't you Jimmy Garvin? And he said, no, but the Garvins are good friends of mine. Of course it was fucking Jimmy Garvin. Jeff, I'm going to interject here for a minute. I am going to disagree with you, Jeff. We almost never disagree. Yeah. This is, let's mark down this date.
We're marking it.
I am a two-time published writer, and how dare you disagree?
There you go. Throw that in my face, damn it. Jimmy Garvin did not impress me during this match, and I got it. So I was a fan of Jimmy Garvin as the babyface, up-and-coming youngster. And I was not a fan of the gorgeous Jimmy Garvin with the strut, the long hair, the what looks like he's about 30 pounds overweight with his big gut. His punches are weak. The kicks are weak. He does take some bumps, I'll give you that. But his offense, to me, is just weak. And I was never a fan of the gorgeous Jimmy Garvin character at any point. Loved him in 79 as a babyface, you know, as this kind of underdog, thin underdog. But as this belly starts to protrude and he's just, I don't know. And you go back and you watch this match and you look at some of these kicks that he's doing, and he was never really known for having this crisp offense. But, you know, just to me, if anything, he was the weak link out of this entire group. And I do think this match, though, was really built around Ronnie Garvin and Jacques Rougeau Jr., because they always seem to spend the most time with each other. But, hey, Lou, I wanted to ask you, too, do you have any context that you can give us about the Garvins in Montreal during this era?
I definitely do. Thank you, Barry. To an earlier point of the beatdown, so that came about because Precious got into Jacques Rougeau Jr.'s face, like she usually would do pre-match, and she always had the can of hairspray for Gorgeous Jim. Ronnie just came up, grabbed the can, sprayed it right in Jacques' eyes, and then just clocked him with it. And Jacques just sold that for a very long time. So it looks like, and I'm looking at a website called cagematch.net, and it says that Jimmy and Ronnie Garvin kind of came into the Montreal territory the summer of 85 for about 2 months. They first came in, and they came in June 10th of 85, and they defeated the team of Dino Bravo and Gino Brito Jr., Gino Brito Jr. being the, of course, the son of another Montreal star who happened to own the Montreal territory at this time. And then they also had a match in Quebec City where they defeated Armand Rougeau, which I think Armand is a cousin of Jacques and Raymond, and his partner, the late Tom Zink. The beatdown comes as the first match first scheduled match between Jacques and Raymond and the Garvins. And of course, that was a no contest. And then that got drawn out to a kind of a series of three matches where the first two, Jimmy and Ronnie, defeated the Rougeaus, first by, I'll assume, straight pinfall in Verdun, Quebec. And then the rematch, it was a DQ finish where the Garvins came out on top. And then we get to the match that we watched, which was at the Montreal Forum. So that was, you know, it looks like they just came in, did a, I would assume, a good amount of business. And then by the end of summer of 85, Garvin got the AWA tag belts with Steve Regal and Jimmy Garvin, that is. And then Ronnie went back to Georgia, which at that point was Jim Crockett South, and he had the Georgia National Championship.
And he had a feud that seemingly went on forever, I think, with Bob Roop and maybe Jake the Snake, too. I don't know if Jake was still there or Jake had gone back to a Mid-South by then. But, yeah, so anyway, first of all, great, great angle involving the dad. The match itself, like I said, between 12 and 15 minutes long. Very heated, lots of good brawling. A fantastic effort by Jacques and Ronnie, as Barry said. I thought Jimmy looked good. Barry, who obviously knows nothing, didn't think so. But, you know, I'm going to post a link to it. It's a lot of fun to watch, and you can think of a hell of a lot worse ways to spend 20 minutes and a fun look back at the 80s. By the way, we want to thank Lou for joining us here because of the change in some of our schedules around the Fan Fest. We didn't send out invitations for reviews on this particular week, except for Mr. Kippelman, who was very nice to accommodate us and to discuss this match and provide a little context. There's a lovely word. So now we want to go, oh, Barry, it is time for what you have foisted upon us, our movie of the week. We are going Savage Streets, an 80s B-movie classic with Linda Blair and a host of other great 80s cheese, including Leanna Quigley. Oh, Barry, tell us about Savage Streets from 1984.
What a fantastic grindhouse-style movie. And this really, you know, the mid-80s, if you take 84 through 86, between movies like Angel, the original Angel with Donna Wilkes and Savage Streets, and then you move on to maybe movies like Tough Turf and The New Kids, there was this whole genre of kind of exploitation of young people, ridiculous kind of storylines and dialogue, but these movies are highly entertaining. This is not great art. This is not your Amadeus. This is not your Gone with the Wind or any movie that's considered a work of art. This is considered, as you've said so eloquently, it's trash. I think you said crap. Yes, it is. But on that being said, these are the kind of movies I feel I can watch over and over and over. And this one stands out really for several reasons, which obviously we'll talk about. But what this movie is essentially is this street gang called the Scars. And the guy is who is the leader of this gang, as you pointed out, Jeff, to me off air, was 33 years old and certainly looks every bit 33. So you do have that when it comes to casting, because a lot of these girls and the guys, you know, with the exception of one or two, they all look like they could be parents. Like, you know, none of them are coming across like they're high school students. But there's this gang called the Stars, and then you've got this kind of female gang, but it's really just a female group of friends. It's Brenda, played by Linda Blair from The Exorcist, and her sister, Heather, who is deaf. She's a deaf mute, because that's really what you've got to have in a movie like this. You got to have a deaf mute, and that's played by
I don't know what you mean by that, but I'll accept it. Go ahead.
Okay.
You need a victim, is what you're saying, Barry.
You have to have a victim. So if you're going to have a victim, why not have this really cute 15-year-old looking deaf mute? I mean, that's like so cliche, but it's so perfect.
She's like the Ricky Morton of the film here.
She's like the Ricky Morton of the film, in a sense. A little bit cuter, in my opinion, but yeah. guess. So anyways, you've got several other girls. You have one that's pregnant. Some of these girls fancy themselves as kind of tough, but you can clearly see that they are. And some of these faces are recognizable. They had done like Love Boat and some other really cheesy movies, probably Friday the 13th, that kind of stuff. So they're out in the street one night, and they almost get run over by this band, this gang, the Scars. And Brenda, Linda Blair, and her group decide to trash the car of these guys. Well, these guys, they don't take too kindly to that. So there is a day at school where Brenda, Linda Blair, and her group are doing something in the school, and young Heather, her younger deaf-mute sister, is left alone in the gymnasium, and the Scars show up, and they gang rape her. And let's be honest, there's nothing funny about that in any form. And it's a very odd scene to see, because in some points, it's borderline gratuitous. When you're watching it, it's a little disturbing. But in moving on, too, the actress who played this was 25 years old at the time. She may look 15, but she was 25. And I will say, Jeff, to interject with this, I got to meet her a week and a half ago. She was at the fan fest that I went to in Gettysburg, PA. She was one of the cast members of Return of the Living Dead. So I asked her, it was really funny when I met her, I didn't ask her anything about Return of the Living Dead. I asked her about Savage Streets, and I asked her a couple of questions, and I said, I watched the movie, and I said, you know, it's definitely a period piece. It's not a movie you can make currently. This is a movie that had to be in the gratuitousness of, if that's such a word, of the mid-80s. And I said, was the rape scene difficult to do? And she said, no, not at all, because the way it was structured, what you see, it's obviously horrific, but what was taking place there, it was strictly an acting job. So it wasn't a real issue. She had to get nude, which was okay, for us and for her, but she said no. And then I asked her about the dialogue of the movie, and we'll obviously talk about the dialogue, because a lot of the dialogue in this movie it's the most ridiculous dialogue maybe of any movie. And then I asked her about John Vernon, and I'll tell you about that as we progress, but she was very coy. She certainly knew what I was getting at, but she wouldn't take the bait. But I said, I forget how I phrased it. I said, John Vernon, he had a pretty decent career. Certainly Dean Wormer from Animal House is his most famous role, but he was in several movies. And
Outlaw Josie Wales.
Yeah, he did. I mean, he did some real, real work too. And his daughter was an actress for years too. And I said, and I believe he was Canadian, if I recall correctly. And he had done a bunch of work in Canada. And I said, he seemed, I think I phrased it, he seemed a little out of sorts in this movie. And she said, if you only knew the half of it. And of course, we'll talk about that because I think I do know the other half. So in any case, Heather is gang raped. There's a fight between the girls and the guys at a local nightclub. And then Brenda's pregnant, soon-to-be-married friend, Francine, she gets murdered when they throw off her viaduct. Well, at that point, Brenda learns who raped Heather. She learns that Francine is dead, and she's really fucking pissed now. So there's a great scene, which, again, we'll get into in great detail, where she sits in a bathtub. And I'm gonna say she sat in that bathtub for 2 minutes, and all they do is focus on her and her grade A breasts.
Spectacular.
They're unbelievable. And they focus on that for 2 minutes, and I guess she's pondering. She's thinking what she's going to do. Well, Brenda's had enough. She's ready to start kicking some fucking Scar's ass. So she finds them in a nearby warehouse. She's got a bow and arrow, what are those things called?
Crossbow,
thank you. It's a difficult word for me. She's got a crossbow. She decides to get the guy with the crossbow. She uses a bear trap to get one guy. She's torturing the other guy and hanging him by his feet. And basically, she decides to take all these guys out. And eventually, the lead guy, who is Jake, who's really the leader of the gang, and he's a guy, again, that was 34 years old, looks 40, if we can even be honest, too, sets him on fire. And that's basically it. And the movie kind of ends at that stage. And they, the movie at the end, it's Heather and their surviving friends, including Brenda and everybody else, go to Francine's grave. And Brenda says, and I'm paraphrasing this, at least we set things right. And her friend Stevie replies, "No, Brenda, you set things right." So this movie has it all. It's got a very basic third grade storyline that anyone could follow. It's got gratuitous sex and violence. And it's got arguably the worst, which makes it the best, dialogue of any movie in the history of film. So, Jeff, I'm going to tell you, I would like to go with the Lariat as my rating system. This gets the finest Lariat possible. Because this is a kind of movie, quite frankly, Jeff, in even talking about this, when we're done recording tonight, I may just go back and watch Savage Streets again.
Well, if you're giving it a Stan Hansen Lariat, I'm going to give this a Dusty Rhodes guys running into the clothesline kind of Lariat. Oh. This was a holy crap fest, just bad cinema. But now that being said, you know, we certainly can appreciate bad cinema. We've talked about it here. Tough Turf, one of our favorite movies. But this, to me, is like a lesser Tough Turf. And, you know, you talked about, you compared some of the movies that, you know, besides Tough Turf. What was the other one you mentioned?
The New Kids, Angel.
The New Kids, Angel. So here's one that you forgot that was from the very early part of the 1980s. I don't know if you remember Jodie Foster in Foxes. Do you remember that movie?
Yeah, but that's almost a little bit more legit, though, because you had Jodie Foster.
No, but I'm talking about the whole, you know, young kids in trouble in L.A.
Oh,
kind
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's as I was watching this is what I thought of. But oh, you're right. That technically speaking, that movie is far superior. This movie somehow managed to score a 6.3 on the IMDb scale, which God help me, I don't know how that happened. But anyway, so yeah, so let's talk about the good points. Two of them are right on Linda Blair in that bathtub scene, which is absolutely spectacular. There's a great shower scene, which for the gentleman out there is completely gratuitous, and you just see girls soaping up, and it reminded me of that old Kentucky Fried movie, you know, the clip they did, Catholic high school girls in trouble, and the girls' breasts were pushed up against the shower stall. You know, it's just like there's no reason for that to be thrown in other than, hey, guys, here, just enjoy these women standing around soaping each other up. And it was a lot of fun. Yeah, so absolutely. We appreciate that. Then there's a couple of girl fights, which may be the worst girl fights I've ever seen. Linda Blair is in a shower with this girl. The other girl is full on just like, you know, showing everything. Linda's like wearing a shirt for some reason, which I guess they figured, we don't want you to show them just yet, Linda. Wear the shirt, let it get wet, but you're not going to show the goods just yet. And the fight, let's just say, it was not UFC rules, because it was just like kind of a little bit of a slap fight. And considering that Linda is supposed to be the bad girl of the school that everyone's afraid of, and this other girl is fighting her because, you know, she thinks that, you know, that Linda's stealing her man and all this kind of stuff, and there's a lot of, you're a whore, you're a slut, and you know, that part, of course, it's spectacularly bad, but it's fun bad in a Tough Turf kind of way. And so as I was thinking, so here's a couple of other things. You talked about the rape scene, okay, which I'm not going to joke about that. You're right. I'm not a, you know, rape scenes in movies are always troubling to me. But what's really kind of troubling is, as I was doing a little research on this film, apparently for the length of the rape scene, which, you know, maybe goes 5 minutes. Apparently there were 12 minutes of additional footage on the rape scene. And boy, am I glad they made the decision to cut the additional 12 minutes out. Thank you for not, you know, foisting that upon us and making us have to suffer through that. So a couple other things, the scene where her friend is murdered. Okay. So they're in the middle of Los Angeles. It's the daytime. Okay. And yet this road has like one car on it. Okay. Apparently this is the part of LA that has no traffic. That's my point, Barry. So, but what I find interesting is here, the guy is holding this girl above his head, getting ready to toss her off the bridge. And the car keeps going because there's nothing going, nothing to see here. Just the homicide that's getting ready to take place. Then after Linda Blair finds out the big news that her friend was murdered and who did it, those sons of bitches, and she's going to get them. There is this great scene after she gets out of the bathtub. Barry, this is what I found myself comparing it to. Do you remember a movie that we've actually, I don't think, never mentioned here, one of my favorite in the 60s when they were doing sort of the comedy westerns, Cat Ballou. Do you remember that movie?
That's a great – is Lee Marvin in that one?
Lee Marvin, Jane Fonda. But there's
a
great –
that's a great movie.
Yeah, there's a great scene where Lee Marvin plays this drunk kid, Shaleen, I think is his name, and he's getting ready for the big gunfight, and this guy is dressing him in all his Western finery. He's setting out his vest, and he's buttoning up his shirt. So they do this scene where Linda Blair's getting out of the bathtub. So she's getting ready to go kick some ass on these guys that murdered her best friend, that gang raped her sister. So she's sitting there, and she's putting on the clothes, and she puts on these little spiked heel boots. Because apparently that's what you want to wear when you're going to kick some guy's ass who's committed these major crimes. And she's putting on the belt and she's got a little sash. And I'm going, this is so fucking ridiculous that this is what she's wearing. Then, of course, she makes the run past the old hardware store, the Army Supply Store, to pick up said crossbow as well as some heavy ammunition. Because, of course, why wouldn't they sell it to a high school girl, Barry? You know, what high school girl doesn't need the crossbow and the heavy-duty ammo? She then goes to the warehouse to find the guys, and she apparently she's also picked up some audiovisual equipment. Oh, God, Barry, the audiovisual scene where she puts these speakers where the guys don't know that it's her, and she's calling it, "I'm coming to get you." And the guy's like, "She's everywhere." And they're starting to freak out because they can't figure out that she's put speakers in this warehouse. And I'm going, where does this high school girl, first of all, where did she come up with the money? Because obviously mom, who, by the way, mom didn't make a lot of movies out of this. And I know why, because boy, you talk about the guy we mentioned off air, the guy from Greece that was a lead heel in Greece that had bad acne. Mom.
Oh, yeah. Woo,
yeah, she was horrific looking, and mom was apparently, I don't know, waitressing or something, struggling, but the daughter's got money to go to the Army-Navy surplus store, pick up the crossbow that's like $289, and plus some other equipment. Maybe she put it on her credit card back then, I don't know. So then she gets into her Mitsubishi, and she jumps out to the warehouse. So now she's in the warehouse, and she ends up, should I spoil it, Barry? She takes out two members of the gang, okay, with the crossbow.
Oh, yeah.
The other guy, the lead heel, comes back. Somehow this young schoolgirl from high school has managed to string these guys up by ropes, not hanging them. She's stringing them up where their bodies are hanging. I'm like, how the fuck does 105-pound Linda Blair string these two guys up? Who, by the way, let me mention, the guy with the bandana, the semi-main event heel, Joe Piscopo. Did he not look like Joe Piscopo, or is that me?
He does. And how old does he look also, right?
Yeah. Yes. He has a chest that I was waiting for the gray hairs to start sprouting on the chest.
Right.
It's like Sam Elliott High School or something like that, you know? So anyway, Barry.
Elliott in High School. I like it. Yes.
So, excuse me.
Jeff, two things we have to bring up before we get to the review. So one is, so we alluded to it. So somebody, and I don't know if they posted this in the Facebook group, in our Facebook group. And I got to say, if you're not on, we've got like 1,700 members, I think, right now. Is that right, Jeff? So 1,300. I'm sorry, 1,300 members.
We're just closing in on
1,400.
I'll just mention that to some of the other groups that may not have quite as many that like to brag about their count. I'm talking to you, McAdam. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. But somebody mentioned it, I think, in our Facebook group when this movie was first mentioned, which is a few weeks ago, that John Vernon apparently had a major – this is allegedly. We don't know. And John Vernon no longer with us. And quite frankly, he was a fantastic actor. Maybe that's not right. He was a very entertaining actor because I feel I could watch John Vernon in anything. But apparently he had some sort of substance abuse problem. And
allegedly.
Allegedly, there was something to do with crack, and he was a big fan of crack at this time, and I think that's what I think a lot of what you see in this movie, allegedly, that he may have been under the influence of crack. And when I asked Linnea Quigley, she smiled at me. She didn't take the bait, but I kind of got the, like, wink, wink, like, yeah, John Vernon was partying pretty hard during the filming of this movie. And we should say, too, he's got this sweaty, pasty skin, which he always kind of had, but in this movie – he looks like he's just taken a bath half the time, and he's all, you know, he's kind of pockmarked and pasty. So apparently he was partying very hard during the filming of the movie. The other aspect is the dialogue in this movie.
Okay, Barry, I'm going to interrupt you here because I am nothing if not giving as a co-host with you. I'm going to serve you up a big, sweet softball for you to hit out of the park, okay? So okay. The scene that Barry's referring to is the gang, those high school youths, the ones that are 30-something years old, that are apparently not going to class, just showing up with weapons in their pockets and coming in, of course, not being confronted by any teachers until the principal of the high school confronts them. And he says, you know, what are you kids doing here? And he's trying to pull away one of the students from these guys who they're trying to shake down. And the kids get smart. The young punks are getting smart with the principal, John Vernon. John Vernon looks him dead in the eye and he says, what, Barry?
Go fuck an iceberg.
What a great line. How many times have you not thought, go fuck an iceberg, when you're talking to somebody that's just pissing you off? Barry, I think we're going to have to make that the line of the week in this movie. Go fuck an iceberg. John Vernon, tremendous job, considering he may have allegedly been under the influence of some substances. So before we finish out, because there's tons more, we could have done an entire episode on this fucking movie. I gotta
be honest. We could have, see?
Yeah.
Great
movie,
Jeff.
We are going to now review... Or go to the reviews by our reviewers this week. We're going to thank Corey McMillan, Ryan Damon, and Joseph Martinez, especially these gentlemen all doing it on short notice. We certainly appreciate your guys. So for those of you who haven't been selected yet, because we were on short notice, we went back to some people that had previously done reviews. So don't get your panties all in a knot because we haven't called on you yet. However, that being said, Ryan, your review. A little on the lengthy side, my man. I'm just going to point that out. So I am going to start off with Joseph Martinez. Then I'm going to let you, Barry, because I know you love doing this, do Ryan's review, and you can edit as you see fit. So Ryan says, hey, guys, thanks for having me on again. This was definitely some parts that were tough to watch, but this movie did have some really good music from the 80s and the grime and dirtiness of New York, if that's where it was from. Apparently, Joseph did not realize this movie took place in L.A., they really did make you want to hate the bad guys in this movie and have them get their comeuppance by Brenda / Linda Blair's character. Side note, she was super hot in this movie. I think we can all agree on that. Other than the puffiness of the hair, Barry, you know, in the final scenes when she's coming to get her vengeance, the hair was super puffy. I just noticed that. This movie had plenty of 80s cheese and hair. I think the feel of this movie would have been better if it wasn't remastered to HD. Some movies just don't need to be remastered to HD just because. Sweet Savage, I believe, Barry, was definitely trashy and cheesy, but that's what it was supposed to be. Hope my review wasn't too long, and I hope everyone has fun at the Fan Fest. We did. Okay, Barry, why don't you take Ryan Damon's review?
Yeah, and I'll take Ryan, too. And I want to say, too, so there are,
Savage
in my
Streets.
Opinion,
we both got it wrong. Sorry about that.
Savage Streets. So there are, so I lived out in L.A. in the mid-80s, and there are two movies that I think when you see Hollywood, which would be Hollywood Boulevard or Sunset Boulevard or, you know, Santa Monica Boulevard, the three main roads in Hollywood, there are two movies that I think capture what it was like back then. This is one. Obviously, this is exaggerated with the violence, but when you look at the life up and down the streets, you know, with the movie theaters and the people walking, that existed. The other one is the movie I talked about earlier, which was Angel, and Angel, which takes place literally on Hollywood Boulevard. She's a student by day and a prostitute by night. I mean, we're talking exploitation to the max. These were two movies that I think capture the grittiness, the dirtiness, the sliminess of Hollywood in the mid-80s. And it's still disgusting. I was out there a year and a half ago. It's a different type of disgusting at this point, but it's still gross. But I will take Ryan Damon. Ryan, with a very, very lengthy review, and then you will get Corey McMillan right after that. When a movie's opening montage includes window shopping for bear traps and crossbows, you can see you aren't watching an ordinary movie. Savage Streets is an exploitation movie from 1984 set on the streets of Los Angeles along with a local LA high school. The movie surrounds the actions of two rival gangs of the Scars, led by Jake, and the Satins, led by Brenda, played by Linda Blair of The Exorcist. The Scars are low-level drug pushers with delusions of grandeur, and the Satins aren't really very defined clearly as what they do as a gang except get drunk and party on the streets. That makes sense, actually. Jake picks up a high school member of the gang, Vinny, in the opening scene, and they go out on the town with their two other members, Fargo and Red. While drinking open containers, Fargo makes a shout out.
That's a county ordinance violation, by the way.
Ryan Damon with the attention to detail here. You got to give him credit on that right there. While drinking open containers, Fargo makes a sharp turn and nearly runs over Brenda's sister, whose name is Heather. Brenda yells at them and explains that Heather is deaf and couldn't hear the horn. Jake makes Fargo apologize and then tries to hit on Brenda. They speed off and end up leaving their car unattended to make a cash run against a guy named Farron. The Satins take the opportunity to steal the car and go out for ice cream. They then park the car and they dump trash on it. Jake uses Vinny to find out where to find Brenda and Heather to exact revenge. We see Brenda at her high school doing some sort of dance class. Heather arrives, Heather being the deaf mute, and Brenda will take a shower and walk them home. While in the shower, Brenda is approached by a rival cheerleader named Cindy. Cindy is super jealous of the attention. We got to say, too, Cindy, how old did Cindy look? She looked about 30, right? Cindy was the
boyfriend
blonde.
Wearing the Letterman jacket who looked about 30, 35, too.
Yeah. Cindy is super jealous of the attention Brenda's been getting from her boyfriend, Wes. Brenda's not interested in Wes because he looks like a slightly challenged Carrie Von Erich.
Accurate.
very accurate. Cindy is not convinced, even though Brenda said, "I wouldn't fuck him if he was the last dick on earth," in quotation marks. A wild brawl ensues in the shower. While this is happening, the four members of the Scars approach the gym and surround Heather. They all take turns raping her, and Jake finishes it off with a vicious kick. Brenda is sent to the principal's office while this is going on and meets with Dean Vernon from Animal House, who I assume was demoted to high school principal after the events of Animal House. When she leaves, people find Heather in her condition, and she is sent to the hospital. After that, Brenda's in the hospital with her mother and Heather. Her mother says she can't deal with this because she has to open her store. So let's just say her daughter's been ganged. She's a 14-year-old deaf mute who's been gang raped. I can't deal with this now. I got to go open up the store, all right? I mean, you know.
Hey, Mom, maybe open it
lunch, consideration
okay?
Here, all right? Yeah, you know, please, I got to open up a store, all right? What about me, all right? Jesus Christ.
I got people that want their papers.
Exactly. I got people who need their gum, all right? I can't deal with this now. Brenda tells her to go, and she will stay with Heather. Later, the Satins meet up at a bar. Brenda meets up with one of her older friends named Charlene and the other Satins, including her best friend and very pregnant Francine. Francine is getting married soon to fellow high school student Richie. They have some plan to leave the streets of L.A. and have a farm after they are married and finish school. Unfortunately, the Scars also end up at this very same bar. Jake collects money owed from Farron and ends up grabbing and trying to force themselves on Francine. Francine fights back and fends them off using a knife, attacking Jake with it. Later on in the film, Jake harasses Vinny enough to tell him where to find the bitch to cut him and ends up throwing Francine off a bridge to her death.
Okay, if I can interrupt you, Jared, just for 1 second, Barry, let's talk about that scene in the bar, which, by the way, that looked like the lamest bar ever.
The lamest ever.
But as Francine is being, let's be honest, physically accosted by this gang, where's the boyfriend? The boyfriend's sitting at the table.
Richie's like
at
10
the
feet
table.
Away.
My pregnant girlfriend, who I'm marrying this week, is being physically accosted. I'm going to sit here and wait to see how things play out.
Yeah, and it's ridiculous.
Maybe the pregnant girlfriend in high school, who I'm getting married to. Hey, by the way, the parents, let's let these kids get married. Let her get a wedding dress, even though they haven't graduated high school yet. And things appear to be not going well for these two. But I'm sure it's going to be a major success when they get married. But, yeah, so the physical harassment is going on. And Richie's like, I don't want to get involved in this. Just, oh, my God.
Richie's, and he's like 10 feet away, but like looking in the other direction. And we got to say, so going back to your first point, this bar clearly a set. This was not a bar. They didn't go film a scene in a bar. They basically took a room. They put like four tables and four chairs in there and put a couple of glasses on a table. It's like the worst looking bar in the history of bars, but it's also like 20 feet by 20 feet. You know, if somebody farts in this bar, everybody's going to know. You've got a pregnant girl getting fucking sexually harassed, and her fiance's 10 feet away, and he's not aware of what's going on. Give me a break. So, again, this is what makes the movie so good. this is it right here. What makes this movie so good right there? So, all right. So, Vinny, back on track. Vinny confesses to the rape when he visits the hospital, confesses to Heather while Brenda was behind him. Brenda does what any teenager would do at this time. She takes a bath to expose her breast to the camera. After that, she goes into full vigilante mode and visits Vinny at home under the guise that they are working on a project together. She threatens Vinny with an...
Wait a minute. I don't want to interrupt you here. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But I just want to point out one thing that I thought was absolutely hilarious about the movie. So when she comes to the door, you know, the father comes to the door. I do not let my son see friends on a school night. He's all nowhere. And Lincoln says, we're here for a school project. I got to talk to him about it. Okay. Now, the father of Vinny, okay, during the closing credits, you have the list of the cast of characters, okay? And at the bottom it says, and Lou DeVito as Vinny's father. And I thought to myself, why did Lou DeVito get an and? What is he like some well-known character actor that I've never fucking heard of? Lou DeVito, and he gets an and after his name? Like, who is Lou DeVito? That was absolutely hilarious. Oh, anyway,
The great Lou DeVito at this point.
Danny's brother.
Sure, right. Danny's brother. She threatens Vinny with a knife, who gives up where Jake is, and then informs her also of Francine's unfortunate fate. Brenda goes to the – we're still on Ryan's review, by the way. Brenda goes to the Scars hangout and booby traps it with the bear traps and also has the crossbow from the store. She uses a tape recording of her making moaning sounds to fool Fargo and Red into thinking she was hot for them. Fargo ends up taking a crossbow to the throat, killing him instantly. Red is dealt with by him falling into a bear trap and ending up with his throat cut. Both are left stood up as Jake comes to the party. Jake earlier ran over Vinny after learning of his betrayal. Brenda then shoots him in the legs with the crossbow, but is now all out of arrows. Because, of course, when you're going into a battle with a gang and you're by yourself, you know, you want to make sure that you have enough ammunition. So, of course, she's out of arrows. Again, it all goes with the story. Jake crawls to attack her, but he is strung up by a trap that hoists him off the ground. Jake uses a close-by chain door to knock Brenda down and gets out of the trap. They fight until Brenda enters a paint store, grabs some flammable paint, throws it on Jake, and sets him on fire while Jake was trying to choke her to death. Brenda and Heather meet up with the remaining Satins at the grave of Francine, and they all place flowers on the grave of their friend to end the movie. Now his thoughts. This is definitely a movie with a lot of nudity at the front end to try to trick you into watching the rest of it. Very uncomfortable with the rape scene, as it really seems like they used a very young actress to play Heather. Having looked it up online, the actress in the scene was actually 26 years old during the filming. She simply has small breasts. Still, was jarring and a very good casting choice. It was a good casting choice. I can't imagine how many girls they had to go through in the casting process trying to find the girl with the smallest breasts. So do you think like Linda Blair was hired for this role? Like, we need to see your breasts. We're casting you on your breasts. And then when they get the girl who's supposed to be 14 or 15, that they also say, we're going to need to see your breasts. They just might have, because Corey McMillan will reveal something. Or actually, I don't know if you had that, Jeff. He reached out to me. I may have to reveal that. Apparently, the guy who directed this movie was a former porn director.
No.
And this is one of his – former porn director. So back to Ryan. God bless you, Ryan. This is one long review, but we're sticking with it, my friend. The acting in it is all around terrible, but it's what you should expect from the genre. Linda Blair delivers her lines with as much emotion as a Vulcan. She She shows some emotion during the bar scene, crying to her friend, saying, "What am I going to do if Heather dies?" Everything else is emotionless. Jake plays his role perfectly, somewhat similar to Luther in The Warriors. As an over-the-top bad guy who makes sure that his comeuppance is fully awesome as he burns to death after being drenched in the flammable paint. As with all high school films of the time, there is a health class scene. Of course, it includes a drawn-on penis of a diagram on the male anatomy. Also, of course, it involves another fight between Brenda and Cindy, which culminates in Brenda ripping off Cindy's sweater, exposing her ample breast to the entire class. I'm not entirely sure why I enjoyed this movie more than Polar. Polar was a movie that I think Ryan a few months ago also reviewed for us, but I know why I would enjoy this much more than Polar. Could the lack of a bloody torture scene, or it could just be nostalgia eyes for this 80s trash film? So bad it's good? I wouldn't go that far. So bad it's decent? So bad it's watchable? Not sure, but if you like a movie with nudity, violence, cheesy one-liners, you might like Savage Streets.
Okay, thank you, Ryan. Now, before we get to Corey's review, let me just offer a couple of things. He referred to the health class scene. So let's talk about that scene for a second, Barry. So we have the teacher that comes in, who's obviously the very mild-mannered guy with the glasses and stuff. And it starts off with he flips up a chart or a drawing, anatomy. And, of course, as Ryan mentioned, there's a drawing of a giant penis on there. And, of course, the crowd starts hooting and hollering in the classroom. And so then there's the fight between Linda Blair and Cindy. And as he said, Cindy's top ends up getting pulled off. But what was great was as the two begin scrapping and as the boobs began flying, the teacher's still behind his desk going, stop, please, you guys, please. No, really, really, stop, please. I don't, you know, and really getting involved there and trying to break up this throwdown between the ladies. And then as he goes in to actually attempt to physically break the fight up, the jock guy, the letterman that we mentioned was Cindy's boyfriend, immediately blocks him from going in to break up fight, where his girlfriend's getting her ass kicked. And then, of course, her boob slide said that was rather rather hilarious how ineffective the teacher was at that particular point of time. So okay, next we're going to go to Corey McMillan, and Corey offers up this commentary. Thank you for always the opportunity to share my thoughts on another film. Well, any worries I had about some boring-ass documentary were quickly put to rest the moment this week's title was announced. As I said in our conversation, quote, "This is the kind of trash I was hoping for the first time I signed up." What's wrong with a good trash, huh, Barry? I must digress momentarily to note that I do enjoy the fine documentaries that have been selected, and I haven't seen them previously as often is often the case. I usually watch after they come up for review. Savage Streets is a film that I recall seeing hundreds of times at the video stores in the 80s, and yet somehow never managed to rent myself. Despite Linda Blair headlining the cast, it was lost in the shuffle of other 80s vigilante slash revenge porn flicks that littered the shelves of whatever mom-and-pop video store we frequented in those days pre-Blockbuster. Being on short notice, we weren't able to arrange for a proper screening on celluloid at the New Beverly, so we'd have to settle for streaming on Amazon Prime. But I assure you, I would not watch this cinematic masterpiece on a laptop or tablet. No, no, this warrants the big screen experience and glorious surround sound on my basement theater, which perfectly showed off that this film wasn't shot direct-to-video along with its terribly mixed mono soundtrack. Having been familiar with the film, I was genuinely excited to give it a watch, and while I can say I've never seen this movie before, I have seen the story about 1,000 times, so I won't bother rehashing the plot. This movie features Linda Blair as Brenda, the school bad girl turned vigilante after a series of encounters with a street gang called the Scars. The movie has everything you'd expect out of something of this genre. Tons of completely gratuitous nudity, not that there's anything wrong with that, including two shower scenes and a, hey, let's have Brenda take a bath scene. You simply can't make these kind of movies today, and they're a treat to watch. Of course, it's absolute trash. Terrible plot, a buildup that takes forever and then concludes way too soon, a rape scene that is both comical and horrifying to watch, 80s dialogue that is politically incorrect, a laughably bad climax where the stunt double is clearly seen as the final bad is dispatched, and I could go on and on. If you're easily offended, there's no point watching this kind of movie, but you can appreciate it for the time capsule it is. It's a treat. We also get to see John Vernon as a hilariously tough guy principal and Leanna Quigley, whose Scream Queen talents are completely wasted here, though her other talents are featured considerably. In an early role, she had about a dozen films under her belt, but would really break out after this flick. Anyhow, big thumbs up for me and recommend it as you if you appreciate this kind of movie. Absolutely stay away from. Otherwise, thanks again for the chance to review. Now, thank you, all three of you gentlemen. We do appreciate your time and efforts. I did want to point out something about Linda Blair, just so I don't forget it. You know, Barry, before she got into doing this kind of stuff, let me reference a couple of other movies that Linda Blair made after the old post-Exorcist fame had come and gone. She made a movie called Born Innocent that was a, for its time, really shocking made-for-TV movie. And she made another TV movie that was also kind of shocking called Sweet Hostage with Martin Sheen. Barry, did you ever see any of those two classics?
I don't think so. She did make a movie that I saw, though, and it was a movie, Night Patrol. And it was a movie, I want to say 85 it came out, and it starred... Remember the unknown comic? Remember that guy?
Yeah.
The guy with the bag on his head?
Yes, it was Murray something.
Yeah, Murray something. So he's in the movie. Billy Barty, who was the midget, is in the movie. So it was a bunch of like B or C or D level actors and guys who may have been big years ago and people who never would be big. But she was one of the featured stars, and I want to say it was 85, and I believe it was Night Patrol, and it was about cops working at night, and it was a comedy, but it was terrible. And it wasn't terrible in the entertaining terrible. It was just terrible.
Well, the reason I remember these two films that I referenced, Born Innocent was really an edgy film for television, because there was a very graphic scene that involved a rape in prison where Linda Blair's character was raped with a broomstick. And I remember that was just really crazy, crazy, edgy stuff at the time. And Sweet Hostage was with Martin Sheen, where he kidnapped her, and they had like kind of a Stockholm syndrome where she ends up falling in love with the guy that kidnapped her, and he kind of turns her from the sweet little innocent thing into maybe not so sweet and innocent afterwards. But that was a pretty scandalous TV film also at the time. So anyway, we want to thank all three gentlemen, Corey, Joseph, and Ryan, for their efforts and helping us out on short notice and reviewing the film. Barry, an absolute trash classic. I also want to mention, just in closing, I happened, as Barry was talking, to look up the career of the great Lou DeVito. Lou DeVito, whose last film after he made Savage Streets was, or I should say his next film, was 1985. He was appeared in Airwolf, the great Jan Michael Vincent, Ernest Borgnine TV show. His credit was, quote, man in crowd. So Lou DeVito certainly deserving of the "and" that came with his name as Benny's dad. So Barry, oh boy, did we have lots of fun with this movie today. And, you know, it's one of those movies. I think Corey said it. If you're into this kind of stuff, you've probably already seen it. You're going to want to rewatch it again. I can already think of, you know, people that, you know, when they find out there's a rape scene, no matter how graphic or how, you know, mild, that's going to turn them off. And I certainly understand and appreciate why you wouldn't want to watch this movie. But there's a lot of great fun in the movie besides that particular scene. And as Barry said, some absolutely laugh out loud. I would have loved to have read Joe Bob Briggs' review of this movie, Barry, because I'm sure he would have torn it apart, and especially the dialogue and, you know, go fucking iceberg. That's going to stay with me for a while.
Yeah, Joe Bob would have embraced this movie too. And there's another one too. When the principal calls the students pussies.
Yeah, that's right.
He calls them a slur for homosexuality that starts with the letter F. I've never heard a principal ever refer to a student that way. So the dialogue really, and actually, I mean, Linda Blair, from a physical standpoint, not a good actress. I mean, we can safely say, you know, definitely not a good actress. But John Vernon steals this movie because he's super intense. I mean, my God, you thought he was intense as Dean Wormer. He ups it here. But he's super intense, super sweaty and clammy, but delivers these lines that, you know, you would have thought at some point point you would have said, what the fuck is this? What am I reading here, right?
Yeah, he said, what the fuck is this dialogue? Give me some blow. And
exactly.
So anyway, that about does it for this episode. Barry, you about ready to take it to the go home?
I think we, this is it. But we will be back next week, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry Facebook group. Go in and check us out. You can also get Jeff's new book by going into the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry Facebook group. And we will have a full recap, including all the shenanigans of the Brothership, because there were a lot of members of the Brothership there, of CWF Legends Fan Fest 5. We have some real stories to share, Jeff.
Absolutely. We want to thank all of you for listening. I encourage you to follow me on Twitter at Bowdrin Jeff, Breaking Kayfabe, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. We want to thank Lou Kippelman for jumping in and helping us review the match from Montreal with the Rougeaus and the Garvins. And we thank him for his fine work on the production duties. So until next week and our details of, good Lord, what happened in Lewis, Florida. We'll talk to you next week.